Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Hey there, fellow true crime aficionados. We're the host of Bad Acts, a true crime podcast. I'm Danielle.
And I'm Aaron.
Join us every Thursday for twisted true crime tales of dark deeds and despicable people. We focus on lesser known unique stories with a new case each week. We've covered family annihilators, cannibals, revenge killings, killer kids, mysterious murders, survivor stories, and much more. We've even tackled stories of people who blamed zombies, vampires, ghosts, and voodoo for their bad acts.
Of course, we know they're the only ones to blame. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts, or you can visit our website at badactspod.com.
If you like fresh stories and new perspectives on crime, Bad Acts will be your new jam. Join Bad Acts every Thursday. Stay safe, y'all.
See you soon.
Welcome back, everybody. How are you doing, Declan?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Before we get started, I wanted to do a couple things. First, I wanted to read an Apple podcast review because I like to do that. You know, that's fun. So This was left by... Where did it go? Disappeared. Here we go. So this is an Apple podcast review from the Alluring Podcast, some friends of ours. It says, cheers to a boozy and bizarre time. This mother and son duo do a wonderful job on researching multiple murder cases and strange mysteries. Many of these topics I've heard on other true crime cases, but they always seem to find some new info about it. Plus, the cocktail recipes they have for each episode are always a fun bonus. So thank you, Alluring Podcast, for that awesome review. We super appreciate it. And if anybody else wants to leave us a review on Apple, we're happy to read that as well. One other thing that I wanted to mention today is I wanted to give a quick shout out to a fun podcast that I've been listening to. It's called Macabre at Midnight. And that's spelled M-A-C-A-B, kind of out of the ordinary, which we like out of the ordinary things here. So it's Macabre at Midnight, and it's hosted by Alyssa and Lindsay. And they tell cool stories about, like, weird things. And they research stuff on aliens and the vampire history and shadow people and, you know, all that spooky, weird, creepy stuff that we love so much. So you can find them on all the, you know, typical podcast platforms. Go give them a listen. And if you do, let us, you know, let them know that you heard about them from us. So, but that's all the housekeeping, if you want to say, that I had for today. I'm ready to get into our stories if you are.
I'm ready.
Okay, what story are you going to be telling us?
I'm going to be talking about Antonio Villas-Boas.
Oh, that's... I don't know that name. You'll have to...
Pretty interesting case. Who are you going to be talking about?
Okay, cool. I am going to be talking about one of America's most notorious serial killers. That, of course, was operating in the Pacific Northwest because I don't know why, but serial killers love the Pacific Northwest for some reason. I mean, of course, there's serial killers everywhere, but we seem to have like a lot of them up here. So,
yeah.
Anyway, it's going to be Ted Bundy. So I'm going to be talking about that.
Interesting. Yes.
So to go with that, I brought the Hacksaw cocktail because good old Teddy Boy was in possession of a hacksaw a couple of times and did some escapey things with it. So the Hacksaw cocktail is 1 ounce of vodka, 1 ounce of orange juice, and 2 ounces of orange soda. And the steps are to pour the vodka and orange juice into a shaker, you know, or you can just put it in a glass and then top with orange soda. That works too. And then add ice to taste. So are you ready for this orangey drink? Okay. Mm-hmm. I just taste orange soda.
It's pretty good.
It's yummy. But it's like, I don't know. I think I broke my taste buds and I don't taste vodka anymore. But granted, there's not a lot of vodka in it. But
It's pretty good though.
I like that. A little sparkle with the orange soda. And yeah, I like that. Yeah. It's decent. Okay, are we ready? I'm ready to tell you. I mean, people know about Ted Bundy or they've heard about him, but, you know, we haven't covered it specifically. So here we go. Ted Bundy was actually born as Theodore Cowell on November 24th, 1946 in Vermont to a single mother, Eleanor Louise Cowell, who went by the name Louise. The identity of his biological father has been disputed, but he was eventually adopted by his stepfather, Johnny Bundy. Ted's early life was fairly typical for the time with a single mother because having a child out of wedlock was severely frowned upon back in those days. You know, that was back in the days where if you were single and got pregnant, they would ship you off to a facility to have the baby, and then if they brought the baby home, it was a sibling or whatever. And that's basically what happened here. So he was raised to believe that his grandparents were his parents and that Louise, his mother, was actually his sister. He didn't know that for a while. So Ted lived with his grandparents.
Back in the day, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was pretty common. I mean, that's got to be weird, though. I mean, that's kind of messed up, but I don't know that contributed to how. Right. And I think he did find out a while later. Although in some interviews, he said that he knew all along. And then other times he said he didn't know. And that's one of the issues with Ted and his story is that he liked to change the story depending on who he was talking to. Okay. So he lived with his grandparents and his mother until he was 3 years old. They lived outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The home life that Ted experienced during those 3 years has been a topic of discussion over the decades. Descriptions of his grandparents are all over the board, with his grandfather being described as an abusive alcoholic, while other people claim that that was not true, that he was not an abusive alcoholic. So again, who knows? His grandmother was described as having mental illness, especially in her later years, but that has also been debated. Louise and Ted moved to Tacoma, Washington to live with cousins before Ted's fourth birthday. Louise met her soon-to-be husband, Johnny, about a year after arriving in Washington. The two ended up having 4 children together, so he's got some half-siblings. Ted's recollection of his childhood years is varied, depending on who is doing the interviewing. He was given details of peeping in people's windows, so at some point, he said that he was a peeping Tom, and that as a teenager, he liked reading true crime magazines. But when he talks about it with other people interviewing him, he denies having done any of those things. And he says those things aren't true. A childhood neighbor of Ted's claimed that he was a mean kid and that he was abusive to animals. So he would be mean to other kids, and then he was not nice to animals, which kind of a typical thing for serial killers, supposedly. Anyway, after graduating high school in 1965, Ted went to college. He attended 1 year at the University of Puget Sound, then transferred to the University of Washington, or UW, where he began studying Chinese. In 1967, he met and started dating another student, Diane Edwards, who he later described as the only woman that he ever loved. By 1968, a year later, Ted decided to drop out of college. He worked in various minimum wage jobs for a while. His girlfriend, Diane, graduated college in the spring of 1968, and she moved back to California. Ted visited her a few months later, but by the end of the summer, she decided that the relationship was over, claiming that his lack of ambition and immaturity was the reason that they broke up. The breakup bothered him a lot, and he went to visit family in different parts of the country, going to Arkansas, Colorado, and Philadelphia. But by the fall of 1968, Ted had returned to Washington State and met a new woman. This was single mother Elizabeth Klopfer, and she worked as a secretary for the University of Washington's medical school. Elizabeth had a 3-year-old daughter named Molly, and Ted began acting as a father figure to the child, which in hindsight is gross and terrifying to think that he was parenting anyone.
Yeah. Well, the kid probably got some kind of weird shit going on.
I mean, I didn't look too much into like the relationship with Molly, but I just can't imagine it was real good and loving. And I mean, he's not a nice guy.
Because this isn't the only girl he ever loved, right? This is a different one.
No, that was his first girlfriend, Diane.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's always kind of a nice slap to the face as the subsequent girlfriends. And also, I mean, spoiler alert, he ended up getting married, you know, while he was in prison. But also, his wife probably didn't enjoy hearing that. You know, the only girl I ever loved, and it's not you.
Yeah, that's pretty rough.
Yeah. Ted and Elizabeth had a rocky relationship that continued for several years. His relationship with Molly was also a rough one, which she described in later years as being abusive and sexually inappropriate at times. So again, not a good father figure. He returned to UW to study psychology in 1970, and a year later, he took a job working at a suicide hotline. One of his coworkers described him as empathetic and kind. This coworker was a former police officer and aspiring true crime author, Ann Rule. Ann Rule ended up writing dozens of true crime novels, including one about Ted, with a personal perspective that other true crime authors didn't have, obviously. I mean, she knew him, so she got to write about that in the book. Ted graduated from college in 1972, and he soon began working for a local politician. In 1973, he was accepted to 2 different law schools, mostly based on several letters of recommendations from the politicians he worked with and some of his UW professors. In the summer of that year, he traveled to California for work, and his relationship with his former girlfriend, Diane, was rekindled. This was the woman he said that the only woman he ever loved. So they got back together. She was surprised by how much he had changed, and they soon started having a long-distance relationship. However, he maintained his other relationship with Elizabeth, as well as, you know, not telling either one of them about each other. So he's got 2 girlfriends now, 1 long distance. He began law school in the fall at University of Puget Sound, and both relationships continued for several months, with Ted even introducing Diane as his fiancée to his boss. until January of 1974, at which time Ted suddenly ended the relationship with Diane. He later explained the relationship as his way of showing her that he could have married her, and she essentially believed that he had been playing her the whole time, trying to prove that she had made a mistake forever breaking up with him. So he goes to California, reconnects with her, and then makes her think that, oh yeah, we're going to get married and all of this. And the whole time he was just stringing her along because he was feeling jilted from when she dumped him years before.
It's very petty.
Very petty. So, I mean, he's a serial killer. So, you know, he's not a real great guy from any perspective. His law school career was short-lived, and he dropped out by the spring of 1974. School was not his top priority at this point, as it would later be discovered that he had a new interest, and that interest was luring and murdering women. Although the extent of his crimes... I mean, as hobbies go, I wouldn't want that hobby. Especially considering where it landed him. Not good. So although the extent of his crimes and when they actually began will likely never be known, because again, he couldn't tell the same story twice, it does appear that he was ramping things up in 1974. That is when his first documented crimes occurred, and those began in January, with the first victim, 18-year-old Karen Sparks, being beaten and sexually assaulted by part of her own bed. Like, he tore, like, it was confusing. I've seen accounts like it was part of a bedpost where it was a metal club, but nevertheless, he assaulted her, and the great thing is she survived the incident. Unfortunately, she suffered internal injuries and severe head trauma that left her with permanent brain damage, as well as vision and hearing loss. For the following 6 months, his victims didn't survive, though. She was the first of that year, and then she did survive. They included young women from around the Seattle, Washington area, as well as out of state, with at least one victim being from Corvallis, Oregon, which is about 4.5 hours away. So he drove to find this girl.
Yes.
Yeah. The frequency of the abductions and murders at the time were about once a month, but sometimes more frequently, with only a couple of weeks between his victims. The victims from February through June were taken at night, but in July 1974, he got braver and abducted two women from a state park during the daytime. This time, there were plenty of witnesses. Some of them he approached asking for help. He took the women separately a few hours apart, but ultimately brought them together and killed each of them, later saying that he forced one to watch as he raped and killed the other. Most of his victims... Most of his victims he found as they were walking down the road, or, you know, like in a parking lot or on the road. As I mentioned, he would ask his victims for help, which is what he did at the park. He would ask them for help, and that's how he lured them in. So he was known to wear an arm sling or use crutches or even wear a fake leg cast because he's, you know, pretending to be injured so that he can get them close and say, oh, my God, I need your help. You know, I've got these books and I'm on crutches. Can you carry these books for me? Can you put them in my car? Because I can't do it because I only have one arm that I can use. The other one's in a sling. And these nice women were like, oh, sure, I'll help you. He would ask the women for help and then either knock her unconscious or restrain her inside his vehicle. Law enforcement was feeling the pressure with the extremely brutal attack on Karen Sparks in January and several missing women over the subsequent 6 months, but there was very little physical evidence anywhere. Because at this point, most of his victims, by like June, July, most of his victims hadn't been found. Like, I don't think any had been found at that point. I think they were all found later that year. So they didn't know that these women were being murdered. They just went murdered. Missing.
They're just missing.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah. It was also difficult because none of the victims were connected with each other, other than having similar ages and appearances. Their appearances, they were typically young with long, dark hair that was often parted down the middle. Due to the July daytime abductions and Bundy talking to several people at the park, investigators now had a solid physical description, vehicle description, and possibly a name of Ted. When he was at the park asking for help, he repeatedly introduced himself as Ted. So he's walking up to people. Hi, I'm Ted. Can you help me? And unfortunately. Huh. Right. Dude. Yeah. Ted, call yourself Ned. Fred. Yeah, I mean, if you can't handle that, it's like, but no, he called himself Ted.
It's very dumb.
Right. Flyers were posted in the Seattle area with a composite sketch, and several people came forward claiming that it resembled Bundy, including his girlfriend. She came for, she was like, hey, this looks and sounds a lot like my boyfriend. And they were like, huh. Ann Rule, the suicide hotline coworker, she also told the police, this sounds a lot like Ted. But because he had basically no criminal history, he was a law student, so they thought he was a good, upstanding citizen. The detectives were skeptical that he was the suspect, so they didn't pursue him. They were like, nah, it can't be this guy. He looks too nice, and he's a student. Couldn't be him.
Does he happen to have a broken leg or an arm in a cast?
No, because it was all fake.
I know.
Yeah. Months after the abduction, skeletal remains started turning up. Most of the victims from this group of attacks would be accounted for eventually, but one has never been located, even though, like, he said, oh, she's here, but she's never been found there. In August of 1974, what?
That's almost creepier. Like, what if someone just came and found a dead body and took it? It's like, hmm.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that. Ew. Well, and considering that, you know, this is Washington, a lot of the bodies were dumped in the woods. And that was, you know, in the 70s, mid 70s, when other serial killers are stomping around in Washington and leaving bodies in the woods. Mm-hmm. Ew, wouldn't that be creepy?
Not a good time to be in Washington.
No, not a female in Washington. Mm-mm. In August of 1974, Bundy was accepted to law school in Utah, so he moved to Salt Lake City. Within a few weeks of moving to Utah, he started attacking women and young girls across Idaho, Utah, and Colorado. The frequency of these kidnappings and murders were also 2 to 4 weeks apart. Since he was living on his own, some of his victims, he took to his apartment and kept them for up to a day before killing them. So he's not just taking them in his car, killing them in the woods. He's like, no, I'm going to take you home and keep you at my house for a little while.
That's gross.
Yeah. In November, Bundy's girlfriend, Elizabeth, learned that girls were disappearing in Salt Lake City area. So she called the Seattle police again. Unfortunately, though, the most reliable witness from the July Lake abductions couldn't identify Bundy from a photo lineup. So again, his girlfriend's like, hey, this guy's bad news, and I think it's him. And the cops are like, well, we don't have any evidence, so we can't do anything. Right? A month later, Elizabeth called law enforcement in Utah to tell them of her concerns, but there was no physical evidence to link Bundy to any of the disappearances. He did not know that Elizabeth had these concerns about him and that she had been contacting the police. he didn't know, but she's telling every cop she can, hey, by the way, my boyfriend, I don't know why you would still have them as a boyfriend. If you thought that your significant other, I mean.
So when he brings the girl home to hold her there for a day, how does his girlfriend not see this woman tied up?
She's still back in Washington. He's in Utah now.
So they're long distance.
Yeah, long distance relationship. But she thinks that something fishy is up with him. Why not break up? Why not be like, hey, even if you blamed it on distance, like long distance relationship, I can't do it. Peace out, bro.
I don't think she wants to be the next victim.
Well, that's true. That's true. Women continued to go missing as he found more victims, and he continued killing them and disposing of their bodies. Some he dismembered and others he discarded into rivers. Washington state detectives continued pursuing leads in their cases, but no new victims were found. Because he was in Utah.
The bodies in Utah.
Yeah. Their spree seemed to have just stopped. As an innovative investigative method for the time, they started to compile a database, cross-referencing people known to the victims, known sex offenders, VW Beetle's owner, as in the vehicle, Volkswagen Beetle, owned by men named Ted, and other things that might be commonality between the victims. His name appeared on more than one of those lists.
Yeah.
He and the VW Beetle thing keeps, like, he had the vehicle.
It's very important. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a beige VW.
Yeah.
If I remember right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's very distinguishable car.
Right. And he was fixated on those cars. Like, he had them multiple times, even stole one. He loved that car. I would be curious to know why.
That was before Herbie came out. So why would you like it?
I don't know.
Right? That was the VW Bug movie.
Yeah. Yeah. It might have been around the same time. I'm not quite sure when Herbie came out. It would have been around the same time, I think.
2005. Way later.
Oh. No, the original Herbie. There was an original one from like the 70s,
looks
I think.
The first one is 68.
Okay. I was thinking it had to be before him because if you're a movie producer and you know that Ted Bundy had a fixation on VW Beetles, are you going to, if I had like written the script, I'd be like, okay, we're going to change the kind of car. It's now a Fiat or something.
I think I'd keep it Herbie and throw a little like Easter egg in there.
True. That's true.
Like Herbie goes to pick up two girls from a park.
And one, yeah. And he's got like a sling on one of his doors and they're like, oh, look, Herbie's injured. That's sick. We're not saying do that. We're not saying don't do that either. Just as they realized Bundy was on those lists, the Washington detectives learned that he had been arrested in Utah. So they're compiling these lists. They go, oh, this guy Ted Bundy keeps popping up. And he got arrested in Utah. The arrest came in August of 1975. When he was seen by a police officer stalking through a residential neighborhood in his VW Beetle. Upon seeing the patrol car, he attempted to flee the area, which caused the officer to become concerned. He's like, what's up with this guy driving slowly, creeping through the neighborhood, and then he sees me, and all of a sudden, he's speeding away.
Red flag.
That's not a good way to, like, post under the radar from shit. Right? So the officer pulls him over, and when he goes to talk to him, he notices that the passenger seat has been removed from its normal location and it's now in the back seat of the vehicle, which would be concerning and weird. So the officer searches the vehicle and he finds a couple of masks. One is a ski mask, and the other is a mask made of pantyhose. He finds a crowbar, handcuffs, rope, trash bags, an ice pick, and other items that were thought to be burglary tools. Police were able to search his apartment, where they found some miscellaneous items potentially linked to a few of the missing girls, but nothing conclusively tied him to them. So they've got these missing girls in Utah, Colorado, Idaho, and he's got some stuff, but nothing that they can say, yes, it absolutely puts him, you know, he doesn't have a driver's license or anything. However, he later claimed that he had hidden Polaroid pictures of several of his victims in his apartment, but the police didn't find them. And when he was let out later, he destroyed them after the first search so that they were never found. But again, he's kind of a liar, so I don't know if that's true or not. I don't think
you can believe anything he says.
Exactly. He's just a big fat liar. There wasn't sufficient evidence found in the searches, so he was released, but police decided to put him under 24-hour surveillance. Probably a good idea. A few Utah detectives went to Seattle to interview his girlfriend, Elizabeth. She noted that Bundy had some strange behaviors, including she would wake up in the middle of the night and find him underneath the covers with a flashlight inspecting her body. I don't know what he was doing. It's creepy and it's gross.
Skin tag on her left butt cheek. Yeah. I wonder if I can take that off.
Watching to see if it grows. I don't know. It's just so gross. The thought of somebody watching you when you're sleeping is so icky.
Fine. Yeah.
It's, yuck. She said that he owned a pair of crutches, that he had plaster of Paris that he could use to make a cast. Like I said, he was known to like wear a fake cast on his leg. She also said he had a meat cleaver that he never used for cooking, surgical gloves, that he had a knife that he kept in the compartment of in the glove compartment of his car, and that he had a bag full of women's clothing.
I'm just bringing these to Goodwill. I don't know.
Yeah, right. Well, okay. A bag of clothing in your car that you're taking to Goodwill will live there for months before you actually take it to Goodwill. Yeah. So, I mean, but those are my clothes. If I have a bag of women's clothes, that's normal. If
true. Not so
if a guy has a bag of women's clothes and the only woman in is his girlfriend and she's like, those aren't my clothes. Then that's weird.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Utah police and the FBI.
Some women to break up with him.
Yeah.
Whose clothes are these?
Yeah.
Why do you have these?
Exactly. Whose are these? I can see that starting a fight for sure.
Yeah.
So the Utah police and the FBI were able to get possession of the car, his car, and performed an intense inspection of the inside. Inside, they found hairs matching three of his victims. None of those victims knew each other, so there would be no reasonable explanation for those hair to be left there incidentally. It was just too big of a coincidence. There's no way to explain that. If three murder victims and this one vehicle has hair from them and they didn't know each other, it's not like you could say, oh, these friends were in my car and they, you know, they didn't know each other at all. There's no chance. At the beginning of October, Bundy was placed into a lineup. One of his Utah victims had managed to escape. Her name was Carol DeRanche. She positively ID'd him as a man who had impersonated a police officer almost a year before and got her into his vehicle. She managed to flee when he tried to handcuff her and he improperly placed the cuffs. So apparently she got upset the direction that he was driving. And she's like, what are you doing? And he tried to handcuff her, but he put both cuffs on the same wrist. And she was able to get out of the vehicle. So he's trying to drive and she's struggling and she's trying to get away and he does the handcuffs wrong and she got out and she got away. So she survived. There were other witnesses that placed him in the area of another abduction, but there was no physical evidence to tie him to that missing girl. Carroll's identification of Bundy led to his arrest for aggravated kidnapping and attempted assault. He was released on bail that was paid for by his parents, and he returned to Seattle, where he went back to his girlfriend's house. Again, she still hasn't broken up with him. Maybe, like you said, maybe she's afraid to break up with him because she thinks she's going to be the next victim if she does, which I could get.
I'd be scared of.
Yeah. I mean, I'd kind of be at that point like, well, he hasn't killed me yet and we've been together. So maybe he won't if we just stay together. Law enforcement was still watching him too, but they knew they didn't have enough evidence to arrest and convict him. In February 1976, Bundy went on trial for Carroll's kidnapping and assault. He was convicted of the crime and sentenced to 1 to 15 years in the Utah State Prison. 4 months later, he was found hiding behind the bushes of the prison. He had an escape kit with him containing roadmaps, airline schedules, and a Social Security card. This little stunt landed him in solitary confinement for a few weeks. Then he was charged with murder in Colorado. The victim was Karen Campbell, and she was taken from the hallway in her hotel, which, you know how I feel about hotels being creepy. And like, I love going on vacation. I love staying in hotels, but I'm also terrified to have my room at the end of the hallway, clear right next to the staircase. It just makes me feel very uncomfortable. And so to know this poor woman was abducted from the hallway in her hotel, doesn't sit right with me. It's scary. Her body was later found near a dirt road. Bundy was extradited to Colorado for that murder in January of 1977. Bundy decided to act as his own lawyer, and the judge allowed him to move through court proceedings without shackles or handcuffs, which, you know, innocent until proven guilty, so we can't have you, you know, impaired in your own defense by having to wear handcuffs or shackles. So, of course, he saw this as an opportunity, and in June of 1977, he managed to escape from the courthouse in Aspen, Colorado. Law enforcement set up roadblocks, but he was able to get into the woods. He broke into a few cabins, stealing clothing, food, firearms, and a vehicle. Instead of driving away, which he apparently could have done, he drove back into Aspen. He drove back into the town where he just escaped from the courthouse. Police pulled him over because he was driving erratically, and they went, oh, cool. We got you back in custody now. He was on the run for 6 days. Yeah. That just doesn't make sense.
Why didn't you go back to that? Any other town.
Right.
Any other town.
Right. I don't know. Not smart, I guess. Legal advisors and friends were convinced that the case against him was thin and he would be acquitted, and they told him so. But he thought he was not interested in going to trial for Karen's murder, and he started planning another escape. This one, he was able to get a hold of a hacksaw. That's the drink I brought today. Yes, he got a hacksaw. He used it to cut a hole in the ceiling of his cell. On December 30th, he placed items in his bed to look as if he were sleeping. He managed to get through the hole. He crawled through the ceiling, and he broke into the apartment of the chief jailer, which I didn't know that jails had apartments for the chiefs and wardens and that. It was kind of interesting. But apparently this jail did have an apartment, which sucks if you're the chief jailer because you live where you work.
Basically live in jail.
No, thank you. No, I don't want that job. Uh-uh. Mm-mm. I want to go home. I love my job, but I want to go home. So on that night, the jailer was out of the apartment and Bundy had changed out of his inmate clothes into civilian clothes that he found in the apartment. And then he just walked out the door. Because he's now wearing city clothes. So he's like, peace out, guys. His escape wasn't discovered for 17 hours. But by then, he had already fled the state and he was in Chicago. For several days, he continued traveling, stealing cars, taking buses and trains until he ended up in Tallahassee, Florida. He was in Tallahassee for a week, living in a boarding house under a fake name. Then his crimes started again. On January 15th, 1978, he broke into two separate locations and attacked five women. Although severely injured in the attacks, three of the women survived. Over the next few weeks, he stole a couple of vehicles, drove to other towns where he attempted to kidnap one girl and did kidnap another girl who was young, and he took her from her school. She was raped, mutilated, and murdered. Her death would ultimately lead to Bundy's own death. On February 12th, he was stopped for driving a stolen vehicle, another VW Beetle, because he is obsessed with them.
Jesus.
He initially resisted arrest, but was quickly subdued and brought into custody. In his possession, he had almost two dozen stolen credit cards and several IDs from female college students. The arresting officer didn't initially know that he had just taken into custody someone from the FBI's most wanted list. He was just arresting him because he was in a stolen vehicle. In June 1979, Bundy went on trial for the two murders at the sorority house. He again acted as his own lawyer, but this time he had a legal team of five court-appointed attorneys for assistance. Initially, there was a discussion of a plea agreement, but Bundy changed his mind. He just was like, no, you're not going to convict me. However, he was convicted of those murders and sentenced to death. There was a second trial for the murder of the young girl that he kidnapped from her school. He was convicted in that case as well and also sentenced to death. Because in Florida, they sentence you to death if you do bad things.
Now, Florida.
Of course, there were appeals. Yeah, go Florida. Of course, there were appeals. And while that process was going, Bundy was talking. He spoke with FBI profilers and biographers. He told them that he enjoyed being a thief and felt like everything he ever owned of any value was stolen. In his mind, sexual assault was like stealing from his victim, and that murdering someone was the ultimate possession. So it, to him, was just stealing.
That's fucking weird.
This guy is just so gross. In 1986, an execution date was set. He then started confessing details of his crimes to the FBI, explaining that he often drove hours to body disposal sites to engage in necrophilia or grooming of several of his victims. Meaning he would like drive to the bodies and put makeup on them and wash their hair and then hang out with them or do other things.
It's fucking gross.
Super gross. Super gross. The FBI also learned that he had decapitated several of his victims, removed their heads, and kept them in his house for a while before finally disposing of them. Due to some legal issues, the execution date was changed numerous times. Since it appeared the execution would finally go forward, Bundy confessed to more crimes, several that he was the prime suspect on, but also several that no one had ever linked him to. Unfortunately, there were some victims whose names were not known. So he was saying, yeah, I did this and this time, but it was, you know, I didn't know who it was. So there's victims that he didn't know their name. They couldn't link to him. So he was finally executed by electric chair on January 24th, 1989, after being on death row for 10 years. So to this point, I haven't mentioned the names because as I was writing this script, I was getting really confused myself with so many names, but I want to be respectful of those victims. So this is a list of his victims, but it is not an inclusive list because, again, we don't know some of their names. He didn't know some of their names. So Jody, here's the list that is known. Jody Lenz, Linda Healy, Donna Manson, Susan Rancourt, Roberta Parks, Brenda Ball, Georgianne Hawkins, Denise Nasland, Janice Ott, Nancy Wilcox, Melissa Smith, Laura Amy, Carol Durant, Deborah Kent, Karen Campbell, Julie Cunningham, Denise Oliverson, Melanie Cooley, Lynette Culver, Susan Curtis, Margaret Bowman, Lisa Levy, Kathy Kleiner, Karen Chandler, Cheryl Thomas, Kimberly Leach. This list of 26 women and girls, yes, there were girls, there were a couple of 12-year-olds in there, could be just the tip of the iceberg. Some believe that Bundy could have had more than 100 victims. And that is Jesus. Some of the details of Ted Bundy. I mean, this could have been a 4-hour podcast if I really, there was a lot.
There's a lot. That's fucking horrible.
Yes. So, tell us your story about this weird...
So mine should hopefully cheer us up a little bit. It's very interesting.
Okay.
Very interesting. So.
Okay.
Antonio Villa-Boas was a 23-year-old Brazilian farmer. As we know, it gets very hot in South America, so Antonio would work on his farm at night to avoid the heat. On October 15th, he was plowing his fields in São Francisco de Sales. It was a normal night of plowing for Antonio, but it wouldn't stay that way for long. While he was working, he looked up and noticed a bright red star, which he hadn't seen before. Perplexed by this, he stared at the star, began moving and growing in size. And it looked like it was approaching Antonio, and once it got closer, he could see that it was a glowing red egg-shaped craft with a spinning cupola on top, which is like, you know, the big bell-shaped things on old churches and stuff, like in Italy.
Yeah, yeah, the dome.
Where I got stuck.
Okay.
In. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it had one of those on top.
Ooh, and it was spinning?
So this craft, yeah.
Ooh. Okay.
It approached Antonio until it extended 3 landing gears and landed right in front of him. This sent Antonio into a panic. He hopped in his tractor, but only made it a couple of feet before the engine completely died. He got off the tractor and ran for a while on foot before a 5-foot-tall humanoid grabbed him.
So they were faster than him.
Yep. According to Antonio, the creature was wearing gray coveralls and a helmet. Antonio tried to get away, but 3 more of them grabbed him and forced him into their ship. He said the creature spoke in a mix of barks and yips. Once inside, Antonio claims he was stripped naked and covered in an unknown gel.
Ew.
The creature's, just gross.
Ew, that's yucky.
The creatures led him into another room, but before he went in, he noticed some symbols he had never seen before. Once he was in this room, he had his blood drawn from his chin.
Chin?
After this, chin, yep.
That's a really poor place to draw blood, I'm thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'd think. After they left him alone in the room for about a half hour before pumping an unknown gas into the room. Whatever this gas was made Antonio very sick. Although, after he was done getting sick from the gas, another humanoid walked into the room. This one looked different, though. It had long platinum blonde hair, large blue cat-like eyes, and was completely naked. Antonio then proceeded to have sex with the alien.
Of his own free will, or was he forced into it?
He wanted to, of his own free will.
Yeah. He was like, she's sexy.
Antonio said that during this, she wouldn't kiss him, but would nip at his chin instead, where he had the blood drawn. When they finished, the alien reportedly rubbed her belly and pointed upwards. Antonio took this to mean that she was now pregnant and was going to raise their child up in space.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
Antonio was upset because he had felt like they had just used him as a booty call.
Oh, for sure. They just came, yeah.
Kidnapped him, made him fuck, and kicked him out.
Wow. And
Antonio was given back his clothes and given a tour of the ship. While on the tour, he tried to steal something from the ship for proof, but was caught and kicked off the ship. Like, well, oh, you ruined it.
Yeah, exactly.
He watched from outside as the ship took off and flew into space. When he made it home, he noticed that he was gone for 4 hours, but it only had felt like one.
Oh, so he was a long booty call.
Yeah. Yep. He experienced nausea, dizziness, and headaches, as well as random cuts appearing on his body for the few following months.
Does Antonio he think that he was abducted, or like, how did the cuts show up?
They just appear. I don't know. There's no really, like, explanation for it.
I don't like that.
The reporter believed Antonio and called National School of Medicine of Brazil to come and take a look at Antonio. They discovered that he was exposed to a large amount of radiation, and his symptoms came from radiation poisoning, which is extremely common among UFO sightings and abductions. Antonio was able to recall his story without hypnotic regression and stuck to his story throughout his entire life.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, super weird. Oof.
I don't like feeling like so many unanswered questions and...
Yeah, that's super weird.
Yeah.
And that happened before the Barney and Betty Hill thing.
It did?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Super weird. Yeah, because Betty and Barney Hill is like the one that most people go to when they talk about abductions and weird. Yeah. Weird.
Super weird.
Well, do you have a chaser? Oh, I'll go with my chaser for sure. You did. Jinx. So my chaser is, I want to say welcome to a Patreon subscriber, a member of our Patreon.
Ooh, nice.
That, I don't know their real name. I guess it could be their real name, but they go by The Weird One on Patreon. And yes, we like having patrons, and thank you for subscribing to us and supporting us and helping us do this fun thing that we enjoy doing. But the fact that they subscribed is not just the chaser. The chaser is the fact that on Patreon we have posted where if you have a chaser and you would like to put your chaser on there, you can go tell us a cool story or something. Or if you have like a really cool, you know, article or something that you want us to read or you think it's cool, we're happy to take a look at those. So the weird one posted, my chaser is that the weird one has graced everyone's day with me being present. Or maybe that should be your chaser, they said. So I thought that was fun and it's wanted funny. To not only give a shout out to the weird one for having joined us, but for making me chuckle at the chaser. What is your chaser?
The watch recommendation for a new movie called Ricky Stanicky.
Oh, is it good?
Have you seen it?
I have not.
It's pretty good. It's got Andrew Santino, John Cena, Zac Efron, some other people in it. But this group of friends comes up with a fake person that they blame all their problems on. So,
I love it.
One of the times they do this, their wives all get curious why they've never met this friend that they always speak about. And so they have to come up with someone who's going to be Ricky Stanicky.
Okay. I have seen the preview for this and it looks hilarious. I love it. Good. Okay. I'm excited to see it now.
Very cool. I think that just about wraps us up. Enjoyed hearing all the details about that. I haven't heard all the details about Ted Bundy yet.
I know. You still haven't heard all the details because I edited it a lot. And because I was writing this and going, I'm already at page 10 and I haven't even finished Washington.
That's funny.
So, yeah, I edited it way down because I was like, we'll be here for 4 days. So, all right. Well, nice chatting with you, bud.
Yeah, good chatting with you too.
Love ya.
Bye. Love you too.